Okay, so the title of the talk is The Idea of Klesha. Klesha is another name for affliction in the Yoga Sutra, and the Yoga Sutra is the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, which is the text which is classical yoga in Hinduism. Klesha, generally translated as affliction, is a technical term and a key concept of classical yoga, as set out in the text called Yoga Sutra, compiled by Patanjali in the 4th century CE. Our purpose here is to explore the traditional analysis of such phenomena as desire, raga, aversion, dvesha, focusing on the I-sense, asmita, and so forth, all described in the literature as afflictions, klesha, and also as erroneous cognitions, viparyaya. The cognitive, affective, and conative features of kleshas will be noted in the light of traditional yoga soteriology. At first, let me briefly outline the basic idea of klesha and its role in the theoretical frame of yoga analysis of the mind and the mental states and modifications of which the standard English translation of the Sanskrit words is chitta and chitta vritti. Chitta is the kind of word which is translated as mind in most of the literature. Ideas dealing with the notion of klesha from various perspectives are scattered throughout the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. This has got about 195 sutras in them, and the idea of klesha is kind of spread out all through the Yoga Sutras. And they are also commented upon in the various commentaries as well. And the main commentary here is the one of Vyasa. Before going into the details of what klesha is and what its implications are, let me recall the striking metaphor of the mind found in the commentary of Vyasa. It reads, "The river called mind flows in two directions, chittanadi nama ubhiyoto vahini," which means that the mind flows in two directions. A proper cognizance of this powerful metaphor, which is at once descriptive and evaluative, helps one to perceive how closely the psychological, the ethical, and the soteriological aspects of are interwoven into the yoga view of the incessant modifications of the mind. The imagery of the two directions transforms the flow of mental life, a metaphor found across cultures, into something more than just a mere psychological description. The two directions are at first characterized as flowing towards good and evil, vahiti kalyanai, and vahiti papayacha, which seems to express primarily an ethical consideration. A further phrase, however, specifies that which flows towards discrimination, viveka, and isolation and salvation, kaivalya, is good, whereas that which leads to worldly existence, samsara, is evil, clearly indicating a soteriological concern. This metaphor of the mind as river flowing in two directions, however, acquires a specific technical significance, as the Yoga Sutra introduces a broad division of all states of the mind, classifying them into two groups, klishta and aklishta vritti, which I'll explain in a bit. This distinction, which is of vital importance for yoga soteriology, involves the notion of klesha. The subtle distinction in discerning the meaning of the word can be seen in the commentaries of the Yoga Sutra. Klishta vritti are those states of mind, we are told in the Yoga Bhasha, which are caused by klesha. These are called klesha hetuka, which means they arise from the klesha. Whereas the Yoga Vartika describes them as those which lead to suffering. Okay? Slightly different kind of connotations there. The modifications of the mind which cannot be thus characterized are called aklishta vritti. Mention must also be made of the notion of samskara. It is said that any vritti or state that arises in the mind leaves behind it a trace, a samskara, which in turn can provoke and reinforce a similar state. Thus, the yoga literature speaks of the perpetual wheel of modification and traces, vritti samskara anisam chakram. A samskara is not merely a memory trace, but also a latent tendency, a propensity which is often compared to a seed that germinates under favorable conditions. The theory also maintains that the vrittis or the states are always known, But that does not hold true for samskara. The latter are said to be, as often in yoga literature in English, as subliminal impressions which remain unwatched, alakishta, that is unconscious. So in other words, the samskaras are unconscious. They belong to the kind of unmanifested state. The technical use of the word, term klesha becomes evident as one reads Yoga Sutra number 2, chapter number 2-3, which puts towards a concise list of the five afflictions or the kleshas. These are avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha, pancha klesha. So the pancha klesha or the five kleshas are avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. So very clearly defined by Yoga Sutra. These may be translated as nisyans, isense, desire, aversion, and fear. These are the five afflictions. Principally concerning this last one called abhinivesha is principally the fear of death. Now the question may be asked, what do these five have in common that allows for the designation of these as klesha or afflictions? These are precisely the five which the analysis reveals that drive the mind towards all that is of the world, samsara. Okay, so all these five kind of kleshas, afflictions, drive the mind towards that which is the transactional or the phenomenal world, which we normally transact with. So that is also blocking the discriminative knowledge, which is essential for liberation or kaivalya. In this connection, it is interesting to recall that these five affliction, panchaklesha, are also designated as five erroneous cognitions, pancha viparyaya, which means erroneous cognitions and kleshas kind of map onto each other, in the sense that if you're ringing, kind of not having the discriminative knowledge and you're thinking wrongly about various things, that will lead towards kleshas. Now, viparyaya, which is the erroneous cognition, is a technical term again, which requires some elaboration. To put it briefly, it is general term for those states of mind which are discerned as erroneous cognitions and which can be negated or corrected by valid means of cognition. So not only does it give all the erroneous ways of thinking, but Patanjali also gives us the ways in which the right thinking can be done. Pramanena badhyate. Thus, if eye sense, desire, aversion, and fear of death are labeled as klesha, they are also viparyaya. It means that each of these is an affliction and gives rise to erroneous view of things. The significance of this description is evidently to be grasped in the soteriological context. So we have noted that the use of the term klesha in yoga literature. Now let us look at, observe that not all the erroneous cognitions are referred to as kleshas. Okay, so there's a slight difference here. Although the five kleshas are no doubt said to give rise to mistaken views of things and hence are erroneous cognitions. So let's look at the first one of these kleshas, which is called avidya. Another name for avidya is ignorance or non-knowledge. Avidya. Vidya means knowledge. Avidya means non-knowledge, which is taken as ignorance or nescience. Heading the list of affliction is precisely this latent subliminal tendency, vasana, of erroneous thinking. Okay, so it is a tendency, it's a subliminal tendency rather than the thinking itself. It is described as the kshetra or the field and the prasava bhumi, which is the breeding ground for the four that follow. This implies that all the klishta vritti, or the afflicted states of the mind, share the main characteristics of avidya, klesha, a predisposition, so to speak, towards taking a thing for what it is not. Now, this is really the core of what avidya means, taking things for what they are not. This can be corrected, it is said, with the dawning of discriminative knowledge. Now, this is another key concept called viveka khyati. Okay, viveka khyati means discriminative knowledge, which is going to lead towards liberation. How exactly the idea of wrong cognition is shown to be the feature of any state of mind that touches upon desire, aversion, fear, or eye sense is clearly indicated in the literature. A smita klesha, which is the second one, is considered as a viparyaya, as it is responsible for taking the impermanent, anitya, for that which is permanent, abiding, or nitya. In the raga klesha, that gives rise to the erroneous view of taking impure, the repulsive, asuchi, as pure and attractive, suchi. The klesha called dvesha is responsible for not discriminating the really painful dukkha from what is pleasing, sukha. And the fourth one, which is abhinivesha, for not discriminating the not-self, anatma, from the self, which is atma. So we can see that here there is a wrong cognition taking place in each of the kleshas, and it is describing, whereas the first one, which is avidya, is a subliminal one, which is really a tendency towards this kind of thing. So these four afflictions, it is pointed out, are not always present in their fully manifest form. A distinctly psychological tone of description of the klesha found in Yoga Sutra chapter number 24 is that the klesha may be dormant, prasupta, attenuated, tanu, intercepted, vichinna, and fully manifest, udara. This is indeed a significant aspect of the yoga analysis of klesha, which have a bearing on the study of emotion. Before discussing the notion of asmita klesha, an intriguing feature of yoga understanding of the mind, let me briefly review the ideas concerning raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. Okay, these are the three kind of ones which follow from asmita and avidya, where the emotive core of the concept of klesha is obvious. Okay, so there's a core emotive core in these three kleshas. The idea of samskara referred to earlier now comes into play an important role in this analysis. The traces of the experience of the pleasure are operative in and supportive of raga or desire. The modification take the form of garda, trishna, and lobha, which may be translated as longing, thirst, and greed, respectively. They also carry the nuance of hankering, attachment, and infatuation, as is clear from the various examples used in the text. Metaphorically, the seeds of sukha samskara, or traces of pleasurable experiencing, are now germinating, actively pushing, and this will give rise to the state of desire, leading to effort directed towards the attainment of the object of pleasure. As opposed to desire, the emotive core of dvesha or aversion is provoked by the seed of recollection of pain. The states that arise are those of pratiga, manyu, jignasha, and krodha, which are in English translated as retaliation, malice, revenge, and anger. These are the ones which call dvesha, cause dvesha. Thus, raga dvesha, or attachment and aversion, or desire and repulsion, dwell upon the samskaras of pleasure and pain. The mind is not repelled by that which is pleasurable, nor does it desire that which is painful. The rittis strengthen the samskaras. Now, samskaras, you remember, are the subliminal traces, okay, which are not accessible in the conscious mind. But the rittis, actually the modifications of the mind, they strengthen the subliminal impressions. So what happens is that there is the concept of the mind which says, you know, the mind is a blank, it is a clean slate. That is not in the Yoga Sutra. So the Yoga Sutra chapter 2.9 deals with a klesha called abhinivesha. The primary meaning of the term in this context is stated in Vyasa's commentary to be the fear of death, the fear of annihilation, which is maranatrasha uccheda drashtra yatatma. Why make a separate rubric for fear of death and not simply list it under dvesha or aversion? Because after all, you know, the fear of death can be seen as an aversion, so why not list it with dvesha rather than create a separate category for that? And there is a reason for that. The abhinivesha is afflicted dread, which it is said the learned share with the ignorant. Everybody shares this dread. Unlike the sukha dukkha or pleasure pain traces, of which examples are easily found in this life itself, the samskara of fear and anxiety concerning death cannot be so accounted for. there being no such experience in this life, the idea of previous death comes into play. This anguish is described as swarasa vahi. It means it arises naturally and spontaneously from the accumulated traces. So in other words, the abhinivesha is not something which we have all experienced, because it's the fear of death. So it is said that it is actually coming from traces from previous existences. But it is still an affliction. It may now be observed that our desire, hatred, fear and I sense are not hidden from us insofar as they are expressed in terms of the vrittis or the modifications of the mind, but the traces or samskaras which they leave behind and which in turn provoke them are not immediately perceived. Now let us focus on klesha that precede desire, aversion and fear of death, and which is placed next in importance to avidya or nescience, namely asmita. Now you remember asmita is the sense of I-ness. Each one of us has got this sense of I-ness. Okay? And I-ness basically has got a kind of connotation that it is associated with this sense of individuality, this sense of body, the mind and the intellect which belong to this individuality. Now this I-am-ness or the I-sense, it is perhaps easier to incorporate raga, dvesha, abhinesha into the basic catalogue of emotion anywhere, but to consider asmita klesha as the same of the mental phenomena might meet with some resistance, because we think that how can this asmita or the I-sense be then categorized with the kleshas. But this is really in terms of the coherent structure of the mind which is presented in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Now this would also involve the perception that the I-sense which is generated as a mental modification due to asmita is eventually analyzable into its heterogeneous components. In other words, the I-sense is not a homogeneous idea or homogeneous experience, but it is two things coming together. A set of ideas needs to be examined carefully in order not to lose the diverse implication of the concept of asmita. It appears in three important contexts in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Number one, asmita as a tattva category. Now, tattva is a technical word, again, from Sankhya philosophy, because the Yoga Sutra is actually based on the Sankhya philosophy and the principles of Sankhya, which says it is a tattva. In other words, it's a material category, which is called the tattva. Secondly, asmita as a klesha or affliction. This is what we've been looking at. And thirdly, asmita as in sasmita samadhi. Now, you know, Yoga Sutra gives a whole kind of range of different kinds of samadhis and the various gradations which eventually end up in kaivalya or liberation. And sasmita samadhi is one particular stage of that samadhi. The first usage is synonymous with ahankara or ego principle in the Sankhya. The Yoga Bhasha, chapter 2.19, lists it as satashcha vishesha asmita matra. As tattva, it shares the five tanmatras. Okay, the tanmatras are the five elements. But we don't need to go into that for the time being. What concerns here is that there is to grasp the sense in which asmita or the I-sense, which is composite but appears as one, ekatma eva, and is diagnosed as an affliction. The Yoga Sutra chapter 2.6 defines it as drik darshan saktiyor ekat atmata asmita, which means that the seer and the experiencer, in other words, the two principles, that of pure awareness, which is called drik shakti, and that of cognition, darshana shakti, as the same as asmita. To put it in other words, the I-sense, which appears to be undivided, because you know we don't have this the sense that there are two dualities or the two sense of I-ness which is contained in our immediate experience, it appears to be undivided, homogeneous, is generated by the non-distinction of the two utterly heterogeneous components called the experiencer and the experienced. Okay, now, I mean, we can go into the whole metaphysical basis of Yoga Sutra and say, now, where does this arise from? But we don't have time for that. Thus, the sense of I-ness and my-ness, ahankara and mamakara, are so intimately related and fundamental to the three kleshas which follow that, that it may be said that there will be no desire, hatred or fear without asmita. Okay, so asmita is really fundamental to experiencing the three other kleshas called the raga, dvesha and abhinivesha. Now, it may be now observed that the order of the klesha in which Patanjali has set it out is not arbitrary. He has got a systematic way of kind of exposing that. And it may now be observed that its significance may also be appreciated when viewed in the opposite order. Now, let's start looking at it in the opposite order, whereby the object of fear in Abhinivesha is hated. Okay, the object of fear, which is death, is hated. This aversion, dvesha, is provoked when desire, raga, is thwarted. And the desire presupposes asmita, or I-amness, which runs through the three. Okay? In other words, you need an experiencer to experience all these various aversions and afflictions. To say that avidya or nescience is the soil for all four is nothing but a soteriological reading of the situation. Okay? To say that avidya or nescience is the soil is really the way in which we are describing avidya as the basis on which all these kleshas are arising. So in other words, it is out of ignorance, avidya, that the rest of this kind of whole structure comes up. This description that the four kleshas are prime examples of erroneous cognitions is especially noteworthy as it cuts through the stereotype opposition between emotive, rational, emotive and rational or cognitive. Normally we say, okay, this is emotional, this is non-emotional or cognitive, but here it kind of cuts across the whole thing. This brings forth an integral view of the mind, and it is in this frame that the picture emerges that the worldly existence, samsara, is not possible without the I-sense, desire, hatred and fear. These govern the mind of the individual and perpetuate the rotation of the wheel of samsara. Okay, samsara is the cycle of birth and death which keeps on going on and on. Briefly, for ethics or soteriology, asmita klesha remains preponderant. Asmita klesha is really at the center, at the core of all these ideas. The egoistic march of the desire, hatred and fear cannot be controlled unless asmita klesha is subdued or weakened. It is therefore important to lay bare the real nature of the I-sense to show that it is not the immutable pure consciousness, the unchanging Purusha, that is erroneously taken to be, that it is generated by an interplay of the self and the not-self. Now, this is the classic metaphysics of Sankhya and also Yoga, that the Purusha, the primordial consciousness principle, and Prakriti, which is the matter primordial principle, come together, and the interplay actually gives rise to this whole existence. So in order to do justice to this complex set of ideas, one has to see how yoga gradually uncovers the two transcendental principles of Purusha and Prakriti. For the moment, it may be said that it is only in that form of intense one-pointed concentration called Sasmita Samadhi that the heterogeneous constitution of the I-sense is observed. It is then disclosed that what was taken to be simple, unchanging or stable is really composite, samhata, and changing, parinami. This is the last or the highest stage of sampragnata samadhi. The yogi who has now to attain the samadhi called asampragnata, when nishans is destroyed and kevalya is achieved. Okay, so sasmita samadhi is one stage below the final stage of samadhi or the meditation or absorption which leads towards kaivalya. Thus, yoga practices are designed to strengthen the aklishta samskaras. Okay, we talked about the klishta samskaras, but yoga practice itself begins to develop and strengthen the aklishta samskara, which are innate and which can eventually subdue and eradicate the kleshas of afflictions of I-sense, desire, hatred and fear, of the four faces of avidya or nescience, gradually assuring an undisturbed flow of the river called mind. And it is in this particular way that nirodha, or the cessation of the complete modifications of mind, takes place, which suspends all the vrittis and all the samskaras, And this belongs to the later stage of yogic practice. So this then is a brief outline of the Yoga Sutra understanding of klesha. Thank you.
Thank you. I found it very interesting. This is something very different from what I study, so
yeah.
You'll have to excuse me. My questions are really basic. But I found it a fascinating introduction to the topic, and it was, and considering that I had not heard many of the words before, it all came through very clearly. And I'm wondering how it compares to other scholarship that's been done on Patanjali before. How does your analysis fit in? Is this a departure from existing trends, or?
I mean, because most of the work which has been done on the Yoga Sutra are of two types. One is that, you know, everybody goes through each and every verse and then tries to kind of give an interpretation of the verse. And there's another set of texts which look at the metaphysical and philosophical side of Patanjali Yoga Sutra. My approach is psychological, in the sense that I approach the whole concept of yoga from a psychological perspective. So you can see a many kind of psychological kind of understanding of what I've been saying. For example, emotion, what is the core of the emotion and how does it kind of fit in with the idea of klesha and affliction, and what is suffering and how does it kind of run through the whole kind of human experience as such. So the difference which I am trying to work on, and this is what my DPhil thesis on, is the yoga psychology, the psychological perspective of the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. So it is different in that way.
Okay. And in that sense, do you see your work as being complementary to the existing scholarship, or how do you see it as being related to what's to the types
yeah,
of
I mean, it
are
is related, and it is in a sense, it is a exploring a completely different dimension. Mm-hmm. So that when I say that, you know, what I'm trying to do is look at the Western conceptions of psychology in terms of human experience, human subjectivity, and to say, okay, now this is a kind of Western way of looking at it, but here there is completely different conception of the subjectivity, human experience, you know, the roots of human experience. So in that sense, it is kind of breaking a slightly new ground, in the sense that I'm looking at a completely different dimension of the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. So it fits in a sense, it is overlapping the metaphysical, philosophical dimensions which are there, but then extending it to human experience from a psychological point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So it extends it towards the Western understanding of human experience, human subjectivity, and say, okay, here are two different models by which human experience is seen and how it is actually considered in the two different paradigms.
Sorry, can I ask another follow-up
sure.
question? Is it you're using Western psychological vocabulary to create
not,
the link?
I'm trying to avoid that. What I don't want to do is to impose any kind of Western words which kind of bring in a lot of baggage with it. Right?
Okay.
So as soon as I say mind, it means something to each one of us.
Okay, so a kind of hermeneutics. Like
yeah, it is
the
hermeneutics.
From
yeah,
inside
yeah.
Itself.
Hermeneutics,
okay.
Phenomenology, and combining the two kind of methodologies together. And hermeneutics is primarily my methodology, which says, okay, what is Patanjali himself is saying? Let the text speak for itself, rather than impose any kind of Western psychological paradigms on what he is saying.
Oh.
And then to speak for itself, so that when it speaks about chitta, yes, I can translate it as mind, but then I have to do a kind of conceptual analysis of the chitta and to see how does it map onto the mind, but there are bits and pieces which are not mapping onto the mind. So that is part of the hermeneutical kind of understanding,
okay.
which is going to be in as part of the thesis.
So are you using kind of current yogic practices as a way to access that hermeneutics, or are you using other types of historical records to access that type of yogic tradition of that period?
No, my primary text is the Yoga Sutra, so
mm-hmm.
I'm limiting my kind of understanding and research based on the 195 verses of the Yoga Sutra.
Okay.
So I'm not moving beyond this particular text, because if I do that, then it brings in a lot of other kind of yogic traditions which have got nothing to do with Patanjali.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for all the questions.
Fine. Are you doing any explicit comparative work?
No, not at the moment. What I have in mind is something which is which is bordering on to speculative, which means that I'm taking the yoga model of mind, which I'm going to develop first of all, and that psychological understanding, then I'm going to say, okay, there is one particular type of samadhi which is there, which is comparable to the idea of flow in Western psychology. Now, the idea of flow is that, it is a specific experience which is experienced by people like artists and athletes and people who get so absorbed in what they're doing that they lose sense of time, they lose sense of subjectivity, mm-hmm. they get so absorbed in that, and they get a lot of pleasure out of the whole thing. Now, what I'm trying to do is that the yoga model of the mind actually can be used to explain this experience in a different way. So whereas the experience itself is the same, in other words, the idea of complete absorption, losing sense of time, losing sense of subjectivity, self-consciousness is lost, it is a similar experience in this idea called flow. And I'm trying to bring those together to see, can the model of yoga, model of the mind, which I'm explicating from the Yoga Sutra, can it be used to actually dialogue with the model of flow from Western psychology. Mm. So that is a bit of a more complicated kind of endeavor. But it takes at about 25% of my thesis. So it is not the major work. The major work is actually looking at the whole model of the mind as it develops from the Yoga Sutra. But taking that one step further, if I say, yes, this is the model of the mind, I can actually empirically test it by looking at yoga practitioners and develop methodologies whereby I can use the model of the mind to predict some kind of outcomes and then empirically test it on yoga practitioners. So that is a kind of bringing the scientific paradigm into the whole thing. But really that is a kind of, as I said, more speculative than the text which I'm looking at.
And there's, sorry, this might sound like a bit of a quirky question, but yeah. There's some therapeutic
absolutely.
Resources there in the...
Yes, so the next stage of development of this whole thing will be, this is part of my kind of, once I finish the doctoral work, the postdoctoral work is to create a whole psychotherapeutic system based on the model of the mind. So when we talk about psychotherapy, one can look at yoga psychotherapy, which is based on the model of the mind, which is created by, this Patanjali's text, and to say there are therapeutic implications in the whole thing, which we look at it from a different paradigm, then it is possible to achieve, balance in the mind through various practices which are being described here.
Ramesh, may I ask a question?
Sure.
This might be I don't know if it's really related to affliction, but earlier in your talk, you said that one of the kleshas seemed to involve a failure to distinguish self from not self.
That's right. Yeah.
I wonder if you could give a brief account of.
Okay. So that
what Patanjali means by self.
Yes. So by self, as I was saying, the whole paradigm, the whole kind of metaphysical basis of Patanjali is actually Sankhya Yoga. So Sankhya Yoga, as you know, considers true primordial principles of the Purusha and Prakriti. Now Purusha is seen as the pure self. One can translate it as pure self because it is Purusha is, in a sense, the individual or the individual consciousness, which is then experienced as the individuality. So when I look at myself and try to trace where my sense of I-ness is coming from, it is actually arising from the sensations in the body, feelings in the mind, and thoughts in the intellect. All this combined together to give me a sense of self. Now, I've taken that to be myself. What is he saying? That I'm actually unable to distinguish between the Purusha which is being reflected in the individuality and the individual experiences which are arising from the body, mind, intellect, which come together to give me a kind of heterogeneous experience of the self. Hmm. And through the discrimination, Vivek Khyati, we can then begin to take those two apart and say, now this is the self, this is not the self. Hmm. Right? So when he talks about in verse number 3, when he says that when the chitta vritti nirodha takes place, in other words, there's a complete cessation of the of the modifications of mind, then the drishta, the seer, is established in itself. Okay, so the drishta is the one who is the seer. Now, the whole point of yoga is really to pull this apart through the various meditations and contemplation, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. It is a kind of way, the whole technology of yoga is based on separating these two components out, so that you come to realize, you know, what your consciousness is. Right? So this is the self and the not-self. Mm-hmm. And the method by which these are going to be separated is vivekhyati, discriminating knowledge.
Very much.
Okay.
Unless there are any sort of burning questions.
One very brief technical question. In terms of the sort of principal placer, it sounded like avidya. In terms of the sort of Sankhya metaphysics, does that sort of take place at the point where Purusha sort of identifies with Prakriti?
So that's
that's the...
Yes, yes. So that is what happens, is that the when the Purusha, the pure consciousness, is reflected in the equipment of the body-mind-intellect, it takes itself to be the body-mind-intellect.
Mm-hmm.
In
mm-hmm.
other words, mistaken identity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the basis of avidya, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Avidya is about not being able to separate out the self from the not-self.